Hi, I'm Stephanie Shelton, and this is Conversations on Health, How We Get There. In the last episode, you'll remember, we talked with Dr. Richard Saltman, Professor Emeritus at Emory University in Atlanta, about the U.S. healthcare system and how it compared with one of the best-known state-run systems, which is the one in Sweden. And we discovered that we have some of the same elements in the U.S. as most state-run European and Nordic systems have. It's just that here they're deployed differently. We also talked about scale. For example, a country with a population of one U.S. state versus the whole U.S., which is a country of more than 333 million people. And we ended part one of the interview with Richard's analysis of why many long-established healthcare systems are running into major problems.
Very simply, the structure of these government-run systems, and I would argue also in the U.S., but certainly in all four Nordic countries, as an example, and we haven't talked about Southern Europe, Spain, Italy, Portugal. The structure of those systems was conceptualized as part of what was, in fact, a prior industrial revolution. It was the management model based in the structure of electricity or electronics, the whole process of the middle 20th century. We are now, as a result of the last 30 years, very deep into the third phase of a third industrial revolution, which is the information revolution, which has completely upended almost all structures of decision-making inside the delivery of healthcare. But what has not been allowed to change, hardly any of the decision-making on the financing side, on the governance side of the healthcare systems in Europe. So they have structures from the previous industrial revolution, which they can't change.
So let's pick up now on part two, the rest of my interview with Richard Saltman. And to refresh your memory, he is the podcast's research advisor. He's Professor Emeritus of Health Policy and Management, Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta. He's consulted widely for WHO, OECD, and the World Bank. He's written or edited 24 books and over 170 articles and book chapters on health policy topics. There's much more on his resume. And again, full disclosure, he's my brother. So, as you might imagine, if you keep up with news on new procedures, implants, and drugs, the elephant in every country's healthcare examining room is costs, rising costs, really, really rising costs. People are living longer, and younger people are needing more medical intervention, as Richard concluded in his Last Industrial Revolution analysis.
This is the challenge to the European systems, which they have not yet met, and helps explain why for the United States or for you or for your listeners to talk about the Europe as an example that we then should follow really doesn't fit the actual factual situation anymore.
I don't think, except for those on the far left, that any thinking person would say we should follow exactly a European system or any other system. I think what is happening in Europe is as I said, they're moving toward more hybrid systems. And what I see in this country is that we already have, in a sense, a hybrid system. But it's so complicated still because of the choice that people may not even want to make, but have to make. I may not want to change my insurance company as a secondary for Medicare at the end of the year, but I have to either change it or reaffirm it. And that requires me to think about what's wrong with me.
Stephanie, you're saying you're a good Swede and you don't like the idea of choice. You want it done for you. You want to have it fixed.
No, it doesn't. It's beyond that. I am looking at costs. I am seeing designer drugs now How are we going to treat cancer? Well, we just had a breakthrough in treating melanoma, which is basically treating it as a virus and having a vaccine, which will ultimately be able to be, quote, designed for different kinds of cancer. This is one way they're going. I know someone
for all the millions of people who have cancer, and for the people who we have known in my wife's family who have died of cancer, that kind of technical, clinical, pharmacological breakthrough is an incredible accomplishment, an incredible blessing, something that should be dramatically expanded and made available to all. They fight about these things in Sweden because they can't get the care. In England, the National Health Service had something called the National Drug Fund, never had enough funding, couldn't provide care for cancer patients, and people continue to die at a higher rate. When it's your relatives or it's you, your view on these things tends to be rather sharp.
It isn't a question of a view. I'm talking, and you know, you have an economics background as well as a health background. I'm talking money, and I don't disagree with you at all on that. Any healthcare system,
of course,
is going to be able in the way it is currently structured, whether this is here with our so-called structure or in another country with their structure.
Right. And what they're finding in Europe is they have to have more and more, they're going to have more and different private sources of funding, because the public sector cannot tax high enough to fund the services. Yeah. In the United States, we have a different configuration and a different set of regulations on the private insurance companies. And thus far, the United States has been superior in its ability to deliver these new drugs to those people who are ill and need them. And that is across the board on all income levels. That's not just tied to those with private insurance.
But I come back to the complexity. I never even thought about it because I had Cadillac health insurance when I worked at CBS News. And then my union, Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, had an excellent healthcare plan, which covered everything and which we paid for every quarter something, but was mainly covered by money that was paying in by producers and money that
employers. Basically, employers. The unions had negotiated the employer increasing and covering in return for foregoing, and this is the key, foregoing wages. You got more benefits, but you got less of an increase
exactly.
in personal wages.
Exactly.
Well, that's a trade-off that unions can make.
But the fact is, I didn't have to think about anything.
Allowed to think about it.
Your union served
it up on a platter, and your choice was to say yes.
Well, you had a choice to say yes or no.
Actually, that sounds very Swedish.
But it isn't. It's not really a choice. It's the fact that it was extremely good coverage of a book this thick.
That's one reason you didn't rebel. Yeah.
And we didn't have to think about balancing these other things. And we didn't have to make a decision every year. You did have to earn a certain level of money within your union in order to have access to this care or not to have to pay more for it.
All right. Well, actually, Stephanie, working for a private university, which is where I worked for 30 years and still associated with Emory University, we had very good health coverage. And the coverage they wanted to steer you into the Emory University healthcare channels, but nonetheless, they did provide very good coverage. That was the benefit of having an employer that was focused in that fashion. There are other employers that are less focused. And now there's something else, which we have not yet discussed. And I hesitate a little bit because it can be complicated, but these are what are called health savings plans.
Yes.
Which are based on a model from Singapore. And in Singapore, the citizens are all required by law to have these private health savings plans. And they make their own decisions about getting care and paying for care from those private plans. However, they are required by law to fund them to a certain level. But the interesting thing about those health savings plans is that if the citizen is able to maintain their health without spending more money than necessary, in other words, personal responsibility with their behavior. Also, of course, there's luck involved in this and genes. But the person gets to keep that money and is able to use it for their retirement. And most interestingly, in a very high tax country, which Singapore is, higher tax than the United States, that money passes tax-free to your heirs if you don't use it. Huh. So they've created a system where everybody is covered. You pay for it with your private money. And then what money you do not spend on healthcare, which encourages people to not spend, and they spend considerably less on healthcare. They spend half of what the Swedes spend on healthcare per person, but their health is exactly the same because they've created incentives through allowing the individuals to keep the money and pass it on to their heirs. So that is a model which increasingly makes sense as healthcare gets more and more expensive and as behavioral issues, your weight, whether you smoke, whether you drink, drive more and more of the clinical problems that appear in the healthcare system.
And that is something that would make a whole podcast later on. It's fascinating. That is
maybe several.
let me pull you back here because we're running out of time. A federal government estimate in 2020 found that there's only 8.6% of Americans now, this is post Obamacare, that have no health coverage, that are not covered in any way, that just go to the emergency room.
Excuse me, that's not
true. Is that legit?
Everybody is covered if they walk into a hospital. Everybody.
Well, yes, but I mean, TEFRA, in terms of...
There's a U.S. legislation, Stephanie, passed in 1988 called TEFRA, which is T-E-F-F-R-A, or T-E-F-R-A, requires a hospital to stabilize any individual before that individual is transferred to another hospital, i.e. to a public hospital. That's number one. So every private hospital has to deal with the pregnant woman who walks in labor. The second thing is that every public hospital takes on board as any patient who appears within the limits of their funding and their staffing. And then we get to a different set of issues. It's not the legal system, and it's not something immoral in the United States. It has to do with local governments and state governments that are not funding the public sector systems sufficient to cover the care that's needed. And then that's where Medicare and Medicaid are supposed to step in.
Right. Well, maybe I misspoke in this. It's 8.6.
No, you've been misled.
Who are uninsured. That was the...
People who are uninsured are not... The problem with people who are uninsured, and it is a major problem, is that they do not get preventive care. They do not get regular primary care.
Exactly. And that's the whole point.
But then the response of that, because we have a very responsive health system, because of the way it's decentralized, is that many of the government-run local hospitals, for example, in Atlanta, Grady Hospital, which is run and owned and funded to the tune of $300 million by the two counties that Grady Hospital is in. Grady Hospital has large primary care clinics that provide all kinds of primary care support. They also have satellite primary clinics out in the communities that provide primary care. And all of this is free if you do not have Medicare or you do not have Medicaid and you do not have private insurance. One of the problems, one of the key problems with the debate on healthcare in the United States is that there are those who would want you to believe the situation is much worse than it is.
Well, that is coming from you and your opinion.
I can back that data up across the board if you'd like.
I do think that if you move out from some of the urban areas, that kind of care is less available. There aren't even
hospitals. That part is true. Rural communities, rural hospitals have more difficulty. However, that is true in Sweden. It is true in Norway. I can tell you story, and also in Finland. I can tell you stories in each country where the politicians have tried to close the local hospital because the quality of care was not good, and they have been stopped because the local citizenry said can't do it. In Norway, they can't do it because of the structure of the fjords, and you have to drive too far and too long if you're pregnant and delivering to get to the next hospital. So they have all these cottage hospitals. The problem is the quality of care, because a doctor who's operating on you might only see 3 or 4 cases a year of the problem you're bringing in. They're not real good at it.
And that was essentially what Dr. Marx in the Czech Republic in our first podcast said about the smaller hospitals in the smaller cities in the Czech Republic, that they cannot get the updated equipment because they can't afford it, and that they do not and are not able to provide the kind of care that you can get in an urban hospital, and that therefore they should be turned into some other part of the healthcare system, like rehab centers or that kind of thing.
Or primary care centers.
Because in a small country, they
can become long-term care facilities.
Right. Yeah. In a small country like the Czech Republic, nobody is that far away from a bigger hospital. But they like to have the ones that are close by, which I think is probably true for everybody. All right. I want to summarize a little now, because we've talked about some of the fact that we've only talked about some of what I wanted to talk about tells me that it is just as complicated as I think it is. But now let's talk about outcomes, just as a last question here. In terms of the U.S. system versus the primarily state-run systems in Europe and the Nordic countries, what about the people on Medicaid? What about the people who are barely covered and never have any regular care? Even the ones on Medicare may not have regular care because they're not pushed to go to a doctor. Maybe there's not a doctor available for them. So in a study that I just saw from the Commonwealth Fund in 2021, they analyzed health performance and outcomes in 11 developed countries, including the U.S., and all but the U.S. have universal coverage. And the U.S. came out dead last, including outcomes, except in one area compared, which was the care process. And it's not the first study that I've seen with similar conclusions, that our outcomes for the money that we spend on a private, specifically private system or hybrid system do not give us outcomes that in many cases are as good as the state-run systems.
That's very interesting. The National Institutes of Health, actually no, it's the National Cancer Institute, has produced data from 2010, 2012, which shows that the United States is one of the 2 or 3 top countries, along with a couple of Asian countries, and also Germany and Switzerland. So actually, what's that? That's 5 countries in terms of 5-year survival rate for cancer procedures. Our healthcare system, when you get into it, is actually one of the best in the world for reasons that have to do with the structure of the Commonwealth Foundation. They emphasize elements that are different. They're not dealing with what happens to the patients. They are dealing with access questions. They are dealing also with primarily primary care related questions, and also, frankly, individual health responsibility questions, issues of obesity, issues of smoking, among others. I am not claiming that the US healthcare system is perfect. I would never argue that there aren't people in a country of 330 million who have difficulty accessing care. No question that exists. But when you start to talk about outcomes, if you look at clinical outcomes, the clinical outcomes in the United States are very good. And actually, the clinical outcomes in a country like England are not very good. I'll give you one short example, which is that there was data published by the British National Health Service in 2017, okay, 5 years ago, which stated in a country of 55 million, we are 330 million. So in a country that's one-fifth our size, there were over 1 million surgical procedures that were unnecessary that took place. That means they anesthetized and opened up people who should not have been treated that way. And the reason was that the government-run system would not provide the capital to create laparoscopic facilities so that you could use keyhole surgery. They had to do open surgery on these people. The government also, which runs the system in the education side, would not provide adequate funds in order to train the doctors and nurses on how to use small tubes in a small incision rather than opening somebody up with all of the consequent results. So when the Commonwealth Foundation proposes to say that the quality of care is better in the United Kingdom, specifically England, because the UK is broken up into four countries, but in England, compared to the United States, I'm afraid, frankly, they don't know what they're talking about.
All right. That's to be discussed further when we look at the...
David Blumenthal is a friend. He will not be happy with that comment. He's the chair of Commonwealth Foundation.
I think you obviously have an opinion. Everybody I talk to has an opinion.
That was data. I can show you data.
I know, but I can show you data, with data going in another. Data is fungible.
No. Well, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, but you'd have to pull that one apart.
It has to do a lot of times with how you look at the question or how you ask the question, as you know. But overall, just to pull it together, we talked about the difficulty of adapting maybe any one type of system to a country this big.
Yes.
And maybe that's really what we should be talking about.
That's a very astute observation.
That we need to look at the issues in the various parts of the country, how much care costs in various parts of the country, and then look around to see what we should change or not change. I mean, it has to change.
The reason I just sighed is because yes, you're right, and then that opens all sorts of doors that are very complicated to walk through.
Well, yes, that's the problem. It's very complicated. And it's so complicated that we're just going to continue this.
One further point about complications. We have not discussed the role of public health, which I know you wanted to add, but which is, there really isn't space or time. Public health is different. We have not at all talked about the relationship between curative clinical care and long-term custodial care, particularly for the elderly, or what we call social care. We have not discussed mental health issues at all.
No, those are all for...
You begin to see the proliferation of the problem.
I plan to break everything down. I think it has to be broken down into areas. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm glad you mentioned...
But the knee bone is connected to the thigh bone. These areas all interconnect.
All right. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to do this
My
at the
pleasure.
last minute, Richard. To be continued.
Indeed.
There's so much more to explore about healthcare and how it's delivered, and we'll be delving into all that complexity again and again in future podcast episodes. Once again, my thanks to Dr. Richard Saltman, the podcast research expert, for coming on the pod. Richard is Professor Emeritus of Health Policy and Management, Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta, and he wears many other healthcare policy hats. I'm sure most of you are aware of the recent nurses' strikes against the UK state-run healthcare system, as well as those here in New York City. Not just about pay, but about continuing understaffing at hospitals and other care facilities. In the next episode, we're going to hear from a veteran U.S. nurse who's been a staff nurse and a nursing supervisor at a number of major New York hospitals. She's been a school nurse, and she's also worked in the public healthcare system. Is there really a nursing crisis post-pandemic in virtually every country? And in her opinion, does the U.S. healthcare system really work for Americans? I'm scheduling one new podcast episode a month, so look for the next one in February. The drop day is usually a Tuesday. Updates wherever you get your podcasts. Please do subscribe. We're on Apple, Google, TuneIn, and on the Podbeam app. And the video version is on YouTube and beyond. I'm Stephanie Shelton, and until I see you again, please take care of yourself and those you love. Conversations on Health, How We Get There is produced and edited by Frank Harold. Research assistance from Dr. Richard Saltman, Professor Emeritus of Health Policy and Management, Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta.